final exam tonight. What I've given you is a discussion sheet that we're going to talk about some things in here. I want to summarize a few things to start with, and then let's have a standing ovation for Kim. Kim's here. Okay. Does this mean that you're going to teach the Thursday class tomorrow, or is it up to me?
It does.
It does. Okay. If you survive the evening, then you'll do tomorrow's class. Okay, that's good news.
This is a trial run.
This is a trial run. Okay. And so we're glad that he's well and back in the saddle again. Back up one more row here. Now, we'll have some discussion tonight, I hope, if everybody is too tired to talk. But be sure you have one of these sheets. Now, we're going to talk about the book of Revelation in its entirety. We're going to look at how it's divided, why it is like it is. We'll discuss all of those things. And I didn't leave room for you to write on much here. In making my own notes for this, I just wrote in the blank spaces there. But you can turn it over and use the back side, because I'm going to show you a slide which has all the questions on it. It looks just like this, except it's formatted a little differently. So you can make notes on the back side. Just put section 1, section 2, and so on. If you want to do that, some of you have these real quick things, and once you see it, it's locked in there for a lifetime. That's great. But I don't really operate that well, too well. Now, there's no clock on the wall. We might be here till 8 or 9 or 10 o'clock. We're going to get through the whole book of Revelation. She has a watch, okay. My wife has a watch and is going to be sure that we don't overrun her. Now let's just think a little bit about the book as a whole. And these questions have come up several times in our discussion over the last 6 months. It's hard to realize it's been 6 months getting through this. And 18 lessons to do it. But the book is a mystery to a lot of people. And I believe the reason why it's a mystery is they don't know the rest of the Bible. If they understood the whole Bible, then it isn't so much a mystery. That's my take on it. And I believe by looking at the timeline of the Bible, which is Ken's favorite topic, that we can see that timeline impressed upon the book of Revelation here and there. And what generally, when I first started this class, I gave you some key verses. I hope you've been following those. Those are the verses on the back of the schedule. If you remember, that was a two-sided handout at the start. And I have a few of those if any of you are interested. There are key verses that give you some landmarks along the way. When it talks about someone turning water into blood, then that immediately should tell you something that he's talking about Moses, right? And if he says something about bringing fire upon his enemies from heaven, that should remind you of something that happened to Elijah. And so you can kind of follow along the history that way. And those key verses which remind us of other verses in the Bible are the verses that sort of pace our way through the book of Revelation. Now, if you want to make Revelation mysterious and make up your own rules as to what the symbols mean, you can come up with almost anything, can't you? And people do come up with practically anything. And I suspect this guy who predicted the end of the world last Saturday night was doing something like that, taking some numbers out of context and calculating and that sort of thing. And I was pleased to see that a lot of people quoted Jesus in that matter and said, he said, Nobody knows when the end of the world is. Not even he didn't know when it was, and the angels don't know. Only God the Father knows. And so, hooray, some people had read and realized that it's bogus to try to predict the end of the world. Particularly, how did he get it down to 6 p.m.? That I don't understand. Anyway. Okay. Pardon me? Well, I don't know. I can't see that makes any difference. He must have been calculating from the Exodus and knowing that it was the 14th day of the first month of the Jewish calendar. If he could figure from the lunar circuits exactly when that was, calculating so far down, I don't know how he did it. But and I haven't looked at his website. I'm not that interested in it. Didn't say which time zone. I presumed it was supposed to be a rolling kind of thing that progressed around the world as it turned, but it didn't happen, so we won't worry about that.
Yeah, that was clarified by a number of disc jockeys with high authority that it was a rolling time zone.
Rolling time zone, okay. So anyway, people are doing those kinds of things with this because other people don't understand it. And Tim LaHaye and his Left Behind and all of those kind of stories takes advantage of the fact that people don't know the Bible. I wrote a book about what we've been talking about for the last 6 months, and I've updated some of my ideas. Every time I teach it, I learn some more things about it. But there's hundreds of references to the Old and New Testament, and I think those have to be taken into account. So we've divided it into 7 sections for purposes of our discussion tonight. The first section is pretty straightforward. We can understand chapters 1, 2, and 3, and we'll talk about them in a minute. And we're going to take each of these 7 sections and subdivide them and ask a few questions about them. That's how we're planning to progress tonight. The second section after the idea of the letters to the churches is a history that runs from chapter 4 all the way to chapter 12. Runs from 4 to 7 in the time zone, in the time before the flood, and it runs from 8 through 12 talking about the history of the Jews and the time after the flood. And then there's the condition of the world in John's time. He's telling us some things about the birth of Jesus, about the fall of the devil, and we'll look at those in detail when we get to section 4. And then the big section in it, in section 5, the destruction of a rebellious Israel in Jerusalem. It's called Babylon. Babylon means confused, and the Jews were definitely confused about their role and what they're supposed to be doing in the coming of the Messiah. And they expected things that weren't going to happen, and what did happen they didn't accept. And so then section 6, which we've spent the last 2 Wednesday nights on, the coming of the New Jerusalem, is about heaven in a way. Most people take it as being about heaven, but it's really about the church, and we'll talk about that tonight. And then the certification conclusion of Revelation is a short section at the end of it. So let's look at the introduction and the letters to the churches. Now, I have here a live microphone. At least they tell me it will work. And if you wish to make more than just a three-word sentence or something, we'll try to get it on record, so we'll pass this around. In fact, I think I will, I don't know who to assign this duty, but I guess one of the audiovisual people will do that when we I hate to assign it to him. But anyway, if you raise your hand and you can answer or talk about the subject at hand. So let's look at section 1. Introduction to letters to the churches. Chapter 1 is the introduction, and chapters 2 and 3 are letters to the 7 churches of Asia Minor. And chapter 1 introduces us to 2 main characters. Who are they? One of them is the author, who is who? Someone named John. Why do we think it's John the Apostle and not John Smith, or John Jones, or John somebody else? Any idea?
Because of where he was and what we know about what happened to him.
Yeah, we don't have any other references to the fact that John was put in exile on Patmos, but it makes sense that that should have happened to him. And we talked about the time, and there's two main theories about that it was either in the time near the end of the first century, or it was in the time of Nero's reign, which is when I think it was, because it is a prophecy about the destruction of Jerusalem, which happened in AD 70. We'll get to that later on. But anyway, who's the other individual besides John that's introduced in the first chapter? Jesus, sure. And so we have the two main characters. We're told about an angel of Jesus who's going to help with this revelation. We're told about God, some things about God. But basically, the two individuals are Jesus and John. And most of the communication in the whole book is about those two individuals. Now, seven churches are described in chapters 2 and 3. I think on your handout it just says chapter 2, but it's two chapters of letters, as you well know. I made a mistake after I corrected it after I'd already copied the 80 copies to hand out tonight, so I didn't want to go back and do that again on that. So it's chapters 2 and 3. What's the purpose of these letters? Some people look at that and say, well, this doesn't make any sense. It doesn't fit with the rest of the book. What's he trying to do in those? First of all, who are the letters to? The churches in Asia Minor. Asia. It's actually what we call Turkey today. Now, why would God have, or Jesus have, John write to those seven churches? Are they Jewish or Gentile churches? They're Gentile churches, aren't they? Is it going to be a big shock to them when Jerusalem gets destroyed? Well, the Christian religion was considered by most of the Roman Empire to be a subset of Judaism. See? So if they may take the view, if Jerusalem's destroyed, maybe this whole business about the Jewish God is bogus. So he's going to tell them some things to reinforce the fact that God knows what's about to happen, and he's going to tell them what's going to happen so they won't be too shocked by what does take place in a few years. But the letters tell these people some things about themselves. What's the main thing that it tells them? Any ideas? To be faithful. But it starts out in each case, it says some things that he knows about these churches.
Some negative things that are happening in their congregations.
Positive things and negative things. In fact, he reveals, you know, the embarrassing aspects of it, doesn't he, in a way? Things that they probably sort of swept under the rug. He says, I know about these things. And so, certainly it reinforces the fact that God knows everything about these congregations. And so they run the gamut from very faithful to kind of lackluster to just barely there anymore. And which church does Woodland Oaks most resemble, in your opinion? Did you go through there? When we studied those, I asked you to consider that. Did any of you come up with a comparison to Woodland Oaks and those seven churches? I don't think we compare very favorably. Well, we compare very favorably to the church in Laodicea, don't we? I mean, we think we do. Okay. If God knows everything about us. So, but on the other hand, we're not under heavy persecution like the church in Smyrna. So that one doesn't really fit either. But one that's doing fairly well, and who, any of you know which one would probably fit best? Don't want to put you on the spot. Are you willing to hazard a guess? There's only seven of them. You've got 15% chance of being right if you just guess.
Say Ephesus.
Ephesus? Yeah. What was Ephesus' big problem? You've abandoned your first love, right? I hope that's not us. Okay.
But there's a lot of good things about Ephesus.
There's a lot of good things about Ephesus, that's right. And maybe we're not as zealous as we ought to be. And Ephesus is a possibility, I considered that. I think really the one is Philadelphia. You know why? He said, I've set before you an open door, a big opportunity. I think that's us. I think we have tremendous opportunities ahead of us that God has planned for us to march right through that door and accomplish everything that we can here in the Woodlands and in other places of the world as well. Well, okay, so there's section one. We'll have to move on if we plan to get through before 10 o'clock. So. The history from creation to Noah's flood, chapters 4, 5, 6, and 7. The scene in chapter 4 describes the throne of God at a particular time, and the clue that tells you when that time is in the praise at the end of the chapter. What is it? What is God praised for? Well, he's praised for his wisdom in the creation, isn't it? And I think that's what the living creatures were saying, and the 24 elders, we talked about that when we went through that. And that seems to be at the beginning, because the next chapter 5 is this choice of someone to be the sacrificial lamb. And that is spoken of a couple of times in Revelation and in other places in the Bible as happening before the earth was inhabited, from the creation of the earth. And so that selection, and who did they pick? Well, obviously, in retrospect, we know they picked who? Who's the sacrificial lamb for humanity?
God's Son.
Yeah, God's Son, Jesus. And so Jesus is his human name, right? And he probably has another name. There is, in fact, in his description over toward the end of Revelation that says he has a name that nobody knows. But anyway, they're searching for someone who opened the scroll. What's this about a scroll? Who's holding the scroll? Well, God has in his hand on the throne a scroll that's bound with seven seals. Remember that? And so somebody's got to open it. Nobody's qualified to do so. And so this mighty angel comes through asking the question, who's going to volunteer? Does he get a volunteer? John is crying weeping because nobody was found who was qualified to open the scroll. And then suddenly we're told, who's going to open the scroll? I think the mighty angel was God's Son. And so he asks, and nobody else is qualified. He's the one who then takes that role. So, and we know in retrospect who he was, who he is. And then in chapter 6, we have the four horsemen. Four horsemen of the apocalypse are pretty strong, pretty strongly recognized. A lot of people know about them and have no idea where it occurs, but they know about the apocalypse and the four horsemen. And who are the, what's the key thing about the four horses? They all have different colors. And the one riding on the first horse is riding on a white horse, right? And we said, some people think that's Jesus, but we're too soon. He doesn't appear on earth too much later. We're talking about Adam, who goes forth to conquer. What's he going to conquer? He's going to conquer, God says, to go forth and rule over what? All the earth, all the animals. Yeah, he goes forth to conquer. And then following him on a red horse is a man with a big sword, and he's going to spread mayhem over all of God's creation, and that's Cain and his descendants. And then that's followed by a third horse, a black horse, which represents famine and hardship. And why would that be the case? Well, you don't realize that would happen unless you do a little bit of calculating about the population of the earth when it's being populated by people who live to be almost 1,000 years old and have 40 or 50 kids in every family, and the population just explodes. And so you have hundreds of millions, perhaps billions of people in the first 1,000 years of population of the earth. And so they can't keep up with feeding everybody. So famine comes next, and that's followed by death. And so now the last of the horsemen is a pale horse. It says a green horse, really, in the Greek. And it's ridden by whom? Death, and followed along. But it's ridden by Hades and followed along by death. Or is it the other way around? It's death and followed by Hades, I guess. And so that's the four horsemen. And they overtake the earth before the time of the flood. And at the time of the flood, then we have a heavily populated earth. And add to that the fact that nobody can grow vegetables and grains and the fruits of the ground except Seth's descendants, because Cain's descendants apparently still have the curse put upon him that the ground won't yield for him. And so they have to be meat eaters. And when we go looking at Cain's descendants that are named there, back in Genesis, we find that one of them is a cattle rancher and one of them is a blacksmith, and they have occupations that don't involve farming. So the farmers, which are the descendants of Seth, have a real tough time trying to feed everybody. So then at the end of chapter 6, we have a big crisis comes, and everybody heads for the mountains. It never says the word flood, but why would they go to the mountains? To hide from God, and the water's rising, see? And they're in the caves, even, in the mountains. And so they resort to the caves because somebody else goes to the mountains in the flood, too. Who's that? All the wild animals, sure. It's a really tough time. And so the end of the world, as they knew it, happens with Noah's flood. And then we see, at that time, we see a complaint by the righteous. Remember that? They were concerned because nobody had taken vengeance upon the people that had murdered them. They were the ones who had stood up for God and been killed. In fact, there wasn't any disease. There wasn't any sickness or anything in those days. And practically everybody that died either died of violence or else old age, I suppose. And we don't know that anybody died a natural death. So here's a whole bunch of people complaining to God that they've not been avenged. And God says, what do you do? Be patient. And the end is coming for these people. And so he told them to wait a little longer. And then we see a story about 144,000 people who've been marked by an angel. Remember that story? So the flood came with the death of the 144,000th person. Who was who? Remember, there was a person whose name means he dies and it is sin. His name is Methuselah. That's right. Okay, so here's the end of the first world. And all of these people who are wearing white robes then means that they are what? Righteous. And they join an even larger group that, looking ahead, God says, now that's just the first, these are the first fruits. And they're called that over in chapter 14. So they join a much larger group, ultimately, that comes from the time after the flood. And these are the righteous wearing white robes. And that's who these people are in chapter 7. Okay, we need to get a little more conversation in the audience now, the rest of this. From Noah on down to the Messiah, in chapter 8, we find a series of angels and trumpets. What do the trumpet calls announce? Remember that? First one, angel... I said, I thought that probably meant that God sends a prophet telling them what's about to happen. And that's the trumpet call. And then what does he send? Well, in our time, it might be tornadoes in the Midwest. Or a tsunami in Japan. Or a giant wave in Indonesia or something. What is it? Disasters, aren't they? A series of disasters announced by trumpet in chapter 8. One of them, remember any of them? One of them was named Wormwood. What was he? Giant rock fell out of the sky? What would we call that?
A meteor.
Or an asteroid. Yeah, a big impact that killed a third of mankind and a third of the ships of the sea and lot of humanity died because the atmosphere was polluted and all the water was polluted and made alkaline. So that was a big disaster. Well, there were others. There were storms. There was volcanic explosions. We talked about the symptoms of these events and how they could be interpreted. What's God trying to do with these disasters? What does he want mankind to do? Pardon me? Wants them to repent, but he wants them to recognize his charge, doesn't he? And the world, where's the world going? Where's it headed at this point in time? What's man's inclination? What was it before the flood? Evil. How evil?
For everything on their heart.
Everything. And so... So I suspect that's what's going on here. People have turned to idols. They've turned. We'll see that in chapter 9. They've turned to idols. They worship the stars of the sky. They worship everything except God, and he's trying to get their attention. So there's a series of disasters. And one of the disasters, after the fifth angel sounds his trumpet in chapter 9, is something new that happens. An angel comes down to earth with a key. He was given the key. And this may have happened before this time. We don't know when he came to the earth, but he was given the key, and then he could unlock something. What did he unlock?
The abyss.
The abyss. Good for you. Okay. He unlocks the abyss, and what pours out of the abyss? What do you suppose was stored in the abyss?
Satan's
lair. Yeah, that was Satan's lair, wasn't it, in a way? But it had been locked, and whatever was in there couldn't get out until the door was open. And then out poured, I think what we're talking about here, are demons. And they're depicted here as what?
Locusts.
A locust plague descends upon the earth. And they have the ability to induce disease in people, okay? I think that's when disease first appeared on the earth, that we're talking about a time when there people lived a long time, and God was intent on shortening their time anyway, and probably about the time of a man who suffered a severe infection like is described here. Who would that be? In the Old Testament. You know his story. A whole book written about this. Job, yeah. And they couldn't understand why Job had this disease because he was a righteous man. Remember, that was a problem. But these diseases were limited at first to those who were idolaters and not God's followers. And so this is something new. I think chapter 9 is about the introduction of disease to the earth. And then the lifespan of humanity drops considerably after that. Now, in chapter 10, a mighty angel brings to earth a little scroll. And what's written on the scroll? Who is this mighty angel? He places one foot on the earth and the other foot on the sea. And here's where we talked about the fact that the earth generally from here on down is going to represent the land. Really is another translation of that Greek word, the land that God is going to give to his chosen people. And the sea represents the tumultuous, pagan, idolatrous world, nations of the world. And so when he steps his foot on the sea, he is really stepping on who? Who is the chief of the idolaters among the humanity of that particular time? It's got to be Egypt. How many different gods did they have? Hundreds. Can you believe it? They worshipped every animal and every rock and every tree, and they had all kinds of idols and temples built to these idols. And they worshipped the sun, they worshipped the moon, they worshipped the sky, they worshipped the Nile River, they worshipped everything. And so this angel who steps on Egypt and then on his the land that he's going to give to his followers is Angel of the Lord, which we think was probably Jesus. But what's on the scroll? He doesn't undo the scroll until they get to Mount Sinai, but what's on the scroll?
On the little scroll?
On the little scroll, yeah. It's just, I suspect it's the Ten Commandments, really, as it's being depicted here. But it's the Law of Moses in its expanded part, but it contrasts with the scroll that was in chapter 5, back in Revelation. That scroll had seals on it. It had to be unrolled a little bit at a time. What's different about this scroll? This one's open. It can be read, understood. It's understandable. Chapter 11, there are two witnesses that are introduced, described in detail. Who are they? Well, I said one of them, they talked about the fact that he was able to turn water into blood. So that's got to be Moses. And the other one, what does he do? Calls down fire from heaven, and he also can call upon God and it will not rain for a long period of time. Who's that's Elijah. Yeah, that's got to be Elijah. So these are the two witnesses, and they represent the two major witnesses of the Old Testament. That's just two individuals. But they also appear on the Mount of Transfiguration, you might remember later on, with Jesus and his three of his apostles. And Moses and Elijah represent what in the Old Testament? The two witnesses for God in the Old Testament are the law, which is Moses' part, and the prophets, which is Elijah's part. And so the law and the prophets bear witness to whom? To Jesus. And he calls them my witnesses. And so now at the sounding of the seventh angel, toward the end of that chapter 11, we have something announced. You know what it was? Remember what that was? Y'all are pretty tired tonight. I can tell from the glazed look on your faces. It starts out, the kingdoms of this world, what?
Have become
the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he, what, shall reign forever and ever. Where did we ever learn that? People know that verse. Where do you get that? That's the verse, if you ever, surely you've heard the Hallelujah Chorus. That was plagiarized from Revelation and Handel's Messiah, okay? Well, a lot of it was about the book of Revelation.
They say it a lot of times over and over again.
It's said over and over and over again, right. So that's a landmark point, isn't it? That's something that happened one time, and it happened at a particular point in history, and so we know when that was. When did it happen that the kingdoms of this world have become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ? When Jesus did what? When he died on the cross?
When he what?
When he rose from the dead? Or what's third possibility? When he ascended to heaven to sit at the right hand of God. Yes, I think that's probably the point at which he began to reign. Okay? So that's a key point in the book of Revelation, halfway through. And there we know is the dividing point between what's in the Old Testament and what's in the New. All right, chapter 12 introduces the birth of the Messiah. Remember that? That's described as a woman. Something miraculous appeared in heaven. A woman with, how was she decorated? How many stars around her head? 12 stars. What's under her feet? The moon under her feet, okay. And she gives birth to a child. And who's the child? Who shall rule the worlds with an iron scepter. That's a prophecy out of the Psalms. Who's that about? Well, this is going back to the to describe the entrance of the Son of God into humanity. He's the one who's born. And somebody's there waiting for her to give birth. This red beast with seven heads and 10 horns on the last head. And we talked about that. He shows up in chapter 13 and is described in detail. He's the beast helper of Satan, who's going to assist Satan by controlling the governments of the pagan nations of the world. He comes from the sea. He comes from the pagan rulers in the pagan parts of the world. And so he's ready to destroy Jesus when he's born. And he's represented in our history by whom? Herod, I think, who was waiting to destroy. And Satan, of course, was behind all of that to get Jesus at the moment when he was born, if possible, or as soon after that as he could. But, of course, he failed in doing that. And so then along with that, in chapter 12, we have the story about the war in heaven and how that Satan was deposed and sent to the earth and the sea, that is, to Israel and to the rest of the nations of the world. In fact, it's said about Satan that he deceived the nations of the world, didn't he? How did he deceive the pagan nations of the world? What did he make them believe?
Their idols.
Their idols, sure. Believe that their idols were effective. And of course they weren't. There's no way they could be. So it's a deception on Satan's part. And so he came down to the earth and the sea. Woe unto the earth and the sea, for Satan has gone down to you. Now there's a second beast, the beast that is the big red dragon with multiple heads, it comes from the stories back in Daniel, and we talked about that when we got there, that this is sort of a chimera of the four previous nations of the world, beginning with Babylon, Persia, and the Greeks, and then ultimately Rome. They sort of make a giant beast which is pagan and anti-God in general and an evil partner of Satan. And Satan gives this beast a lot of power. And the beast gives a lot of his power to another beast that comes from the land, the beast of the earth, the beast of Israel. Israel decides they want to be like the nations of the earth. You see, that fits exactly with what happened back in the Old Testament. And so they said, let us have a nation, let us have a king like everybody else. And so that got them into trouble. Their king again and again, and all of that history of the kings down through the time until Babylonian captivity, most of those kings were terrible. And they were following the rule of the big red multi-headed beast. They liked what he was doing. And so this is the beast that's also called something else. This beast of the earth is called a false prophet. And when he's captured ultimately, as we'll see in a few minutes, that's what he's called. And that's the beast who has the number. What's his number? 666. We talked a little bit about what does that mean. That turns out to be, and it says, this is wisdom. And when that's a clue. When it says, this is wisdom. What's the number of the beast? What does that mean? Well, who do you associate with wisdom? Solomon. And 666 is the amount of gold and talents that he received from the other nations every year in his reign. He was a multi-billionaire with all of that gold. It depends on what you assign as the price of gold, but as it is today, it would be. Now, and the terrible thing about that, how they ruled and controlled, was it was an economic thing. You notice you couldn't buy or sell unless you had the mark of the beast and that sort of thing. That's how you controlled people. Wouldn't let them do things unless they towed the mark. And so that's materialism is the meaning of all of that. That's one that we really have to pay attention to in our time. Chapter 14 talks about the 144,000 again that we saw back in chapter 7. And those are the people that came out of the first earth at the time of the flood. They were the righteous. And so at this time it says they were following Jesus. And you wonder, well, why is that inserted here? And the answer apparently is that they were not released to do that until Jesus had made a sacrifice and returned to heaven. And interesting thing about their salvation, it says that there were two characteristics, but one in particular that they all had. They never lied. Always told the truth. That was a major thing about them. Well, question.
I'm confused about the 144,000 being the people that came out after the flood.
They came out of the time before the flood.
Oh, okay.
They were the saved from the time of Noah. The flood destroyed all of the wicked people in the earth, and there may have been billions, and yet only 144,000 who were righteous.
So these were the people that were righteous before the flood and then had died.
That had died, right. And they were, most of them apparently were already dead before the flood came. Their souls were under the altar of God, you recall, and they were asking about vengeance. Now, three angels show up in chapter 14. We're going to have to move along because we're going to run out of time in a minute. An angel announces the eternal gospel. If you ever think about the gospels being eternal, we think about it as being started at the time when the church began. But it's spoken of here as the eternal gospel. What's that? Well, somebody can read that. What does it say? It amounts to the same thing as the gospel that Peter preached and Paul preached. Fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come. Worship him who made the heavens, the earth, the sea, and the springs of water. It's interesting that it mentions the springs of water. We talked about the water last week. But here, this would be true throughout history, wouldn't it? If anybody would accept what God had said and worship him and do his will, that's what God expected. And, of course, that involves something more in the Christian dispensation and obedience to Christ. But that's the eternal gospel. Two more angels announce the fall of Babylon. Who or what is Babylon? And we talked about that. How do we know who Babylon is? Well, the descriptions of it in about five different places say that they had killed the prophets. They had stoned those that were sent to them, and that sort of thing. And we went back and looked at what Jesus said about it. How often I would have gathered you as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you would not. And in that same context, he talks about the fact that they had killed the righteous people that were sent to them. So we think that Babylon really in the context has to be Jerusalem, because that's what's mentioned again and again in the story of its destruction. Now, the destruction of a rebellious Israel in Jerusalem, chapters 15, 16, 17, and 18, it takes a while to get through all of this, and I don't think we have to look at all the details, but it hinges upon the fact that the Jews had made a very rash oath at the crucifixion of Christ. What did they say to Pilate? His blood be upon us and our descendants, our children. They should not have cried that, should they? And so God's wrath is poured out upon them. The seven angels are given seven bowls containing the wrath of God, and it's going to be poured out upon Babylon, in this case Israel. But you know, I think that using another name for it instead of just saying Jerusalem or Israel warns us that the same sort of thing could happen to another nation who does who turns against God the way Israel had turned against them. And so that makes it a little more general than it would have been otherwise. We'd look at that and say, well, that's just Jerusalem. That isn't the United States. It isn't England or somebody else. Well, it could be if we do what they did. The seven bowls are poured out in sequence. That's what they're going to do. Pour the bowls out upon Babylon, upon Jerusalem, upon Israel. The battle starts in northern Israel and proceeds to the final siege of Jerusalem. But who described these events? You should remember that. Someone that didn't write in the Bible, but he wrote an account that was preserved for us. Who? Josephus. And the details fit the kinds of things that are described in the Bible among the wrath of God poured upon the people. Things like sores and disease and catapults of stones and things like that. Chapter 17 tells us how God has viewed the behavior of rebellious Israel. What did he consider her? A prostitute. That's right, an adulteress. She was supposed to be God's wife. And she had turned against him and worshiped and served other idols and other things that had left God out. And he considered that to be adultery. Chapter 18 is a lament over fallen Israel. And I found that most interesting because 17 tells us what God thought about it. 18 tells us what the other men, other people on the earth thought about it. What did they think? They talked about it in terms of what? Commerce and the fact that we can't sell our goods there anymore, and we can't get some things that Jerusalem provided, and it's just a terrible turn of events that Jerusalem's destroyed, and of course they aren't thinking about spiritual matters at all, and mostly they're thinking about selfish things. So, is that any different than today? That's right. We tend to view, and that's why I wrote this book and entitled it Heaven's View of Rebellion and Faithfulness, or Faithfulness and Rebellion, because God's view of things is often quite different, and that's kind of what he was trying to tell the churches in chapters 2 and 3, how he viewed what was going on in those congregations as opposed to what they thought was important. So now in chapter 19, this section is really pretty important because it talks more about us than any of the rest of the book. Chapter 19, we learn about the wedding supper of the Lamb. What's that? Well, Jesus gave a parable about inviting the king that invited everybody to the wedding supper for his son, and what did they do? Hey, I got some cows I got to go see. I bought a land. I want to go see what that looks like. I married a wife and I can't come. That's a good excuse. So they all gave excuses. And what did the king do? Anybody come. But he also, in that and some other parables that he talked about, sending his army and destroying their city. He was pretty upset about the fact that they wouldn't come. So who's invited? Actually, who's invited to the wedding supper of the Lamb? It's an open invitation, isn't it? They went out into the highways and byways and the hedges and the places looking for people to come. Then we see Christ on a horse followed by the armies of heaven. Who are the armies of heaven? Actually, they're going to do battle on the earth, and they're wearing white robes. I suspect it's the church, but it may be those who have died that are righteous. But I suspect he's talking about following Jesus as his people should do. And the dead, well, let's see. Who do they capture? And that's a critical point because they capture the two beasts, the multi-headed dragon and the beast of the earth, and where are they thrown? To the lake of fire. That happened right after the destruction of Jerusalem. Fortunately, we don't have any world empires anymore either, like the ones that the big red dragon governed and that sort of thing. So the world changed at that point because Jesus took those two creatures out of circulation. Now, he has also going to have a future there for Satan himself, and we'll look at that in a minute. Chapter 20 tells about those who reign with Jesus. Who are they? Well, when you look at it, at first it says they're the martyrs. But the word martyr doesn't mean what it does to us. Do you know what the word actually means? The word martyr actually means? It's a witness. That's right. And the witness is who had been beheaded. And I think that's just a description of every Christian. You've been beheaded. Do you know why? Because you turned over your life to another head. Who? To Jesus, sure. He's your head now. And what happens to Satan? First of all, he gets locked up in the abyss again, doesn't he? And then the dead are judged. Incidentally, about Satan, how long was he in the abyss? 1,000 years, a long, long time. Near the end, he apparently has to be released. And then at the end, he gets thrown into the lake of fire. And then we have the great white throne judgment. The dead are judged. Who are the dead? Well, we're talking here not about people who have died physically, but we're talking about people who have died spiritually. And so they're judged. They come from all over. They come from Hades in the story that's in Revelation. And they also come from the sea. Now you see, that's a mystery if you think about dead people, somebody who fell overboard and was eaten by a shark, and there's not anything left of him. But that's not the sea. The sea are the pagan nations of the earth, and they're full of people who are spiritually dead. And they all appear before God, and Ken had talked about their judgment. You stand before God, and you're asked, have you ever done anything that you told somebody else they shouldn't do? And of course, everybody's done that. You live by any rule you want to. You don't follow it. And therefore, you're condemned. The creation of New Jerusalem begins in chapter 21 and part of chapter 22. It allows God to do something that he's long desired to do. And all of this history is designed to allow him to do what? Dwell among men. Yeah, with the righteous. To make men righteous so he could dwell with them. That's been his goal all along. And he couldn't do that with Israel because they never were righteous, were they? He could do it with individuals like Moses, but never with the whole kingdom. And so it's talked about the New Jerusalem's like a big city, like a big cube. And we mentioned last week the fact that God dwelt in a cube in the tabernacle and in the temple as well. And now he's in this huge cube that includes all Christians. And how do you get in? Go through the gate. And what are you doing when you go through the gate? You're washing your robe. That's in chapter 22. Who can't enter? Those who are wicked can't get in, can they? You have to be purified. And before closing Revelation, John is shown the river of life and the tree of life. Where does the river originate? Flowing from the throne of God. Okay. What does the river signify? What's it symbolic of? If the river that flowed out of Satan's mouth was lies, the river that flows out of God's throne is what? Truth, yes. And Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. We talked about that last week. There's a tree. What's it called? Tree of life. And what does it provide? Apparently provides fruit, which is used as food. And it also has, its leaves are used for what? Healing of the nations. And you see, that wouldn't be a story about heaven. That's a story about the earth. That's a story about the here and now. We have access to the tree of life and the river of life. And we need to understand how we can heal the ills of humanity with what we have in Christianity. So the book of Revelation is certified by two witnesses. Who are they? Over in the 22nd chapter, the first one is certified by John himself. He says he was the one who heard all of these things and wrote all of these things. And then somebody else comes in and certifies it as well. Who was it? It's in red letters in my copy. It's Jesus, wasn't it? Said, this is what I have revealed to John. And so then he says something about the Spirit and the bride say something. What did they say? Come do what? Come take of the water of life freely. Yeah. And so, and who can come? Anybody can come. It's an open invitation. And what warnings are given about the not altering the book? So two very serious warnings are given, aren't they? If you add anything to it, the plagues will be added to you. And if you take something from it, you'll take away your part, the tree of life. Yeah. So there you have it. In 1 hour, we got a late start. We got through before the hour was up. The book of Revelation summarized in an hour. Now, I hope you followed along. You have a copy of all of these things that we projected. And think about that. And I also have copies of the book which describes the whole story. If you got into the thing late, would like to look at the book from which I've been preparing this material. And we didn't use our usher here with the microphone at all. But any of you have any comments? Yeah, we have enough.